This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2022, held at Horizon Mennonite School in Hagerstown, Maryland, on March 4 and 5.
It's good to be with you. I was 10 or 11, and I came across an illustrated story. The story was of a Jehovah's Witness who was 9 or 10. And as the story goes, he was on his way home from school. And he was regularly mocked, made fun of, because of his belief in a God. And so on his way home from school, a group of older boys kind of cornered him and started picking on him. And the situation continued to escalate. And they got rougher. And eventually, he ended up, he kept sticking to his statement, there is a God. He was adamant. But as I said, the situation continued to escalate. And the boy ended up being stabbed by one of the older boys. And as he lay on the sidewalk, he dipped his finger in his blood and wrote, there is a God. Supposedly it's a true story. I tried to verify it. It was many years ago. I'd actually forgotten about it until I started thinking about this. And it came back with a vividness and a clarity. And I remember the impact that that story had on me as a young boy. And just the injustice of it, the wrongness of it. And you know, I pondered that story for weeks. What would I have done if I would have been the boy? Would I have been able to stick to what I believed in that kind of opposition? How would I respond to the older boys if I could have joined the young boy in the story? Imagine projecting myself into the story and helping it have a happy ending. But there always remained a nagging sense of sadness and loss, because that opportunity was gone. I was too late. It was too late. You know, the story ended before I could do anything. And so many times that becomes a heart cry of those close to these unfortunate situations we call bullying situations. If only I could have. Why didn't I see? I wish I'd have another chance. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, I just pray that you would be with us as we think about damaging relationships and what you're calling us to do and ways that we can intervene and we can grow young people and help them to be followers of you. Just pray you bless our time together, help it to be profitable. We ask this in your name. Amen. So the title of the session today is Confronting Cliques and Bullying. Our goal is to give you the information, the awareness, and the motivation to help us as leaders speak into these situations before it's too late. Cliques and bullying damage people. They damage the victim, the perpetrator, and the bystanders. Those people inside the clique and the ones outside the clique are all damaged. We need to do our part to mitigate these issues among our people. School needs to be a safe place. So before you can solve the problem, you need to identify the problem, right? So I'd like to look a little bit, spend some time looking at what bullying is, and then look at some ways that they can be addressed, ways we can grow people through that. So Webster defines it as a blustering, browbeating person, especially one who is habitually cruel, insulting, or threatening to others who are weaker, smaller, or in some ways vulnerable. And you know, as I was thinking about this and doing some research, it became clear there are a number of types of bullying. Obviously, the most obvious one we think of is physical bullying. I was recently doing a job. I'm taking a year off from teaching school and doing construction. And so I was working right outside of elementary school. And I'm putting siding on, and the kids are having recess and stuff. I get to see them interact, and it's interesting. And this is not to slam public schools. I attended public school. The staff, they care about it. They want to do their part. But this is what I observed happening. It was probably kindergartners, maybe first graders. And they were playing, and one of the bigger kids came up, and they were looking at each other, and then suddenly he just threw his arm around his neck and just like threw him down. Well, his buddy came up, wasn't very impressed with that, and he did the same thing to him. So they looked at each other, and then the two little boys ran off, and the bigger boy went on about his agenda. And this was all supposedly supervised playtime, but I found it interesting that the teacher who was on duty, there were several teachers there, missed the whole thing because she was on her smartphone. So we could probably have a whole other session on that, but that's not where this is going. But it happens. And if we're honest, it even happens, those kind of things happen more than we realize, and we need to be aware of them. The thing I wrestled with later was, so should I have taken initiative and talked to the staff, or should I have kept on siding the house? What was the right thing to do? How is it going to be perceived? I'll let you chew on that. We may pick that up later. So physical bullying or physical intimidation, mistreatment is happening. Another type is verbal. It can be unkind words, mocking your ancestry, abilities, intelligence, appearance, anything. And it ranges from subtle to very, very blatant. And I had to think of Proverbs chapter 18, verse 21, says, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. Death and life. You know, some people have found this to be all too true. In 2021, Isabel Tichenor, whose school district was found by the Department of Justice to be, quote, deliberately indifferent to known student harassment. She resorted to suicide to escape the bullying. She was 10 years old. February of 2022, Drake Hardeman also committed suicide in response to bullying. He was 12, just like Eli Fritchley, who had also committed suicide in November of 2021. Life and death is in the power of the tongue. Another type of bullying is social and emotional bullying. And it may seem at first like we're splitting hairs here because they're both verbal, or tend to be, but verbal abuse would be words that I speak directly to you to damage you, hurting words. Social and emotional is more words where I spread rumors, I spread lies and gossip. I deliberately exclude and belittle and put down among peers. Verbal bullying attacks you, the person, while social and emotional bullying destroys your standing and acceptance within a group. Some of you are probably feeling a little bit like I was when I first started hearing this stuff about social bullying, you know, and anti-bullying laws, and it's like, okay, wait a minute, so why are we talking about this? The examples I gave were from out there, right? This doesn't happen in our nice, well-run Anabaptist schools, does it? I thought it was just out there. But I was thinking of it only in the physical. And I think we've been raised in a way that we tend not to express ourselves physically nearly as readily. But our children growing up, they may not do it as much physically, but verbally and the social aspect of it, I think many times happens more than we realize. And I realize as well that we have enough unfortunate situations in our own schools to curb any kind of finger pointing. But do we have the same basic problems? They're just less toxic. Is that okay? And then my mind went back to another incident that happened when I was a young boy. My family attended, we chose to go to another concerted Anabaptist church for revival meetings, a church we didn't normally attend. So as we went there, afterwards I was standing in a group of boys my age, and we were talking as boys tend to do after church and discussing different things and telling stories and recounting interesting happenings, etc. Enjoying the camaraderie, the sense of a group. And one of the boys' ride was ready to go, so he left. And as soon as he left, the other boys started filling me in on all his shortcomings and telling me how he couldn't be trusted and how he exaggerated and lied and how, you know, this thing that he said, that probably wasn't true, and informing of specific instances as well as habits and tendencies. I remember thinking, I wonder what they're going to say about me after I leave. There was social and emotional damage happening. How was I supposed to process it? How was I supposed to sort through that? But you know, it's an age-old problem. It's been here for thousands of years. In James chapter 2, reading from the New Living Translation, "My dear brothers and sisters, how can you claim to have faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ if you favor some people over others? For example, suppose someone comes into your meeting dressed in fancy clothes and expensive jewelry, and another comes in who is poor and dressed in dirty clothes. If you give special attention and a good seat to the rich person, but you say to the poor one, 'You can stand over there or else sit on the floor.' Well, doesn't this discrimination show that your judgments are guided by evil motives?" James has laid out the case. He's clearly against being a respecter of persons, which is the foundation of bullying. "You're different, so that gives me the right to treat you badly." Another category of bullying that came up is cyberbullying. And it's probably going to vary a bit depending on the level of technology that we have in our schools and available to our children. Basically, it's using social media or the internet to bully someone with photos, video clips, slander, etc. But I find it interesting that as phones or media becomes more of an extension of our personhood, our expression of who we are, to that same extent, cyberbullying becomes much more destructive. And it's harder to combat. And some of the examples that I gave of the children who committed suicide, the adults in their life weren't aware of what was going on. And they missed the opportunity to speak into that situation. So who are the perpetrators? Who are the ones that are doing this? Conventional wisdom would probably have it that these are people who come out of unfortunate situations and they're acting out because of their environment or the things that are not right in their life. And there, to a certain extent, that does happen. It's labeled as a bully victim, someone who is mistreated by older people or people that are perceived as more privileged, and then they in turn mistreat other people younger than them, or that they, and so you get this ripple effect going on. But I found it was interesting. So you do have some what they call a bully victim, but you also have what they call a pure bully. And this is someone who is socially well connected, and they have a pretty good self-esteem, pretty good image of themselves. And so you're saying, wait, so why do they choose to treat other people this way? We'll explore that maybe just a bit more in the next point on causes. But discovering the pure bully broke the expected mold. And so we can't say they're just a product of their environment or the circumstances. That's what the behavior is. It's more than that. So what are the causes? Why do children, adults, exhibit this kind of behavior? I think the bottom line is we're born sinners. And many times we forget that even when we're working with children from good homes, until they become Christians, they're unregenerate sinners. And they're going to have those tendencies. The Jeremiah 17:9 says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" Anytime someone enjoys causing another person suffering, that's wickedness. And for the purpose of our thinking together today, I would say let's avoid an overemphasis on trying to figure out why somebody is doing something. What are the causative factors? Because while many factors are relevant, they're still responsible for their actions. And we need to think about how to help it stop, not try to figure out, because the circumstances don't automatically cause the behavior. Gordon Neufeld has some interesting thoughts on what happens when we look to our peers instead of our parents for affirmation and value. If or when your peers turn on you, the emotional impact is like being rejected by your God. Life becomes unbearable and pointless. And so I think part of the reason why it's maybe more of an issue in our day than it was maybe 75 or 100 years ago is because of that shift in valuing my peers more than the adults in my life. Interesting observation. So what about cliques? One researcher said, cliques are a form of social and relational bullying. And so I'd like to think a little bit about what is the difference between cliques and healthy friendships? You know, because I've heard people make this statement. Well, some people you just get along with better than others, you know, and there's nothing wrong with having good friends, and they're right. But how do you discern whether it's an unhealthy clique or whether it's a healthy friendship? I'll give you two criteria that I feel are relevant to discerning this. If it's a healthy friendship, it's not going to exclude people intentionally. So a healthy friendship will not exclude people intentionally. A healthy friendship has room for others. It's not clingy or exclusive. And so, while we have good friendships, if there's never room for more people in those friendships, they may be unhealthy. One of the ways we can discern that. What are some of the identifiers that help us know, is this okay, or, oh no, we have a problem, this is not okay? The website, A Brighter Day, had a number 6 points to helping sort this through. Cliques usually have 1 or 2 leaders. So there's usually 1 or 2 who kind of have a bunch of followers, and that constitutes the clique. Cliques focus on maintaining their popularity or their status. They focus on maintaining their popularity or status. Cliques generally don't socialize outside of their group. So there's this activity happening, and oh, this person or these people aren't going, I'm not going to go either. They don't socialize outside of their group. Members of a clique tend to be more concerned with keeping a good relationship within the clique rather than making friends outside of the clique. Members of a clique tend to be more concerned with keeping good relationships within the clique rather than making friends outside of the clique. The 5th one, cliques are mean. even to members within the cliques. Cliques are mean, even to members within the cliques. Cliques may pressure their members to make poor choices or to follow along on things they don't actually want to do. I found that interesting. Cliques may pressure their members to make poor choices or to follow along on things that they don't actually want to do. I'll tell you a story of a young man who traveled to another conservative community and was hanging out with some of the other young men there. And one of the things that they decided to do was to watch a movie. This was a number of years ago when it wasn't as accessible as it is today. And he'd had a long day and fell asleep. When he woke up, he was appalled at what he was seeing. He said, "Guys, this isn't okay. Turn that off." Nobody moved. "Guys, this is not okay. Like, turn that off or I'm leaving." Nobody moved. They all knew it wasn't okay. All it would have taken was for one person to take some initiative. But they were immobilized. So he stood up, walked out the door, and started walking down the road. Didn't have a clue where he was at. Hadn't been in the community. And eventually one of the guys found him and picked him up. May pressure their members to make poor choices. I would have said that gave evidence of a clique, not of healthy friendships. So what are some of the patterns that we develop? You know, patterns can destroy a group. Cliques, rephrase that. The pattern of developing cliques and reacting to cliques and developing counter cliques can very quickly destroy the functioning of a group. I've taught school for a number of years, actually 20 years. Last year was my 20th year. Taking a sabbatical this year, and I'm planning to go back in the classroom next year. And in some ways, last year was probably one of my tougher years. Some of those factors were outside of school. Some of those factors were within school. And one of the things that I faced was this very thing that we're talking about here. Cliques and divisiveness and counter-cliques. And one of my goals has always been and continues to be helping my classroom function as a group. We're all part of it. We do things together. And it was just disintegrating. There were falsehoods being spread, breaches of confidence, bad attitudes. I didn't know where to start or what to do. And you know, one of the reasons that I think it's difficult to work with these kind of things is because they can be such a variety of expressions and so many different ways that the nuances of how things fit together. So I was seeing the evidence on the surface that I could go after those behaviors. But it's a little bit like cleaning up a flower bed by taking a scissors out and snipping the weeds off. You can work really hard and it looks good today, but a week or two down the road, it doesn't look like you really did anything. And that's a little bit what it felt like until we got to some of the stuff that was going on under the surface and we were able to address some relationships and some interactions and try to help things turn around. The end of the year did go much better than the beginning of the year, but I was amazed at how quickly the function, the energy, and the feel in my classroom had just disintegrated, is probably the best way to put it. So the pattern of cliques and including, excluding kin destroyer group, it can also continue into adulthood. I found something I thought was fascinating. 7 ways workplace cliques harm the work environment by Sherry Gordon. I'll just share a few of her thoughts. I think they're also relevant to schools and maybe even churches. She says, excessive togetherness is bad for companies because those on the outside become distracted and dissatisfied with the work environment. They may even expend more energy trying to cope with the clique than they do on their actual job. Another quote. One way to prevent employees from ostracizing others is to assign them to group projects instead of allowing them to choose their own groups. Now get this. When you allow employees to pick their own groups, you're opening the door to workplace bullying. As a teacher, that resonates. When we allow students to choose their own groups, are we opening the door to bullying? Another way that workplace cliques can affect employee morale is by making a big deal out of the things they do together. For instance, cliques often laugh and share inside jokes that other employees do not get. These secrets create an unbalanced workforce because some employees are feeling left feeling like outsiders instead of a part of the team. Which may be another way to indicate, is it a good friendship or is it a clique? You guys have all experienced that, where there's an inside joke and everybody laughs and you're left wondering what the deal is, okay? My premise is, if it's a friendship, someone say, yeah, you know, what was funny was, and they'll explain it, and they'll pull you into the loop. There's room for more people, okay? If it's a clique, you're just left hanging, you know, and it may come up again. And everybody laughs. Ah, and you still don't know what was funny. So like I said, we need to know what the problem is before we can solve it. So what do we do? What are some ways that we can confront these issues? What are some ways that we can... And from a secular viewpoint, many strategies have been tested with little or mixed success. And part of the reason for that is this thing called the bystander effect. I'd like to break that down for you just a little bit. So the bystander effect is the phenomenon where people are there. They know what's going on, they see what's happening, and nothing happens. We've all either seen it or been a part of it. And there's basically 4 reasons why that is. I'll give you the long wordy version and then just a short soundbite that I think summarizes that. So why don't we get involved? Why do we allow the bystander effect to keep us from getting involved? Number one. The witness believes that the incident is not their concern or none of their business and thus elects not to get involved. In other words, it's not my business. It's not my problem. I don't need to worry about it. Not my business. Number 2, the witness believes, correctly or incorrectly, that intervening may draw negative attention from the bully and likely he'll become the bully's next target. In other words, I'll be next. I'm not going to get involved. Or I'll be next. Third possibility, the witness does not want to violate unwritten codes of conduct among students by telling an authority figure. In other words, I don't want to be a tattletale. The fourth possibility is the witness believes that intervening will neither stop the bully nor help the victim. In other words, it won't do any good. But I think as Christians and especially as leaders, we're called to do something different from the bystander effect. And so there are 4 things that I think we need to practice, we need to do, we need to engage in. And they're listed here. I'll give you the first word and I'll fill out the rest. So the first thing I would say is label the action, speech, or attitude clearly. Label it clearly. Otherwise, the students can assume that your lack of action implies agreement with the bully, with the bullied student's value. In other words, I'm being bullied because I'm worthless. And if the bystander or use the adult doesn't speak into that situation, oh, that must be the proper assessment. And you know, a lot of times I, as a teacher, as a parent, I like to find the perfect solution. You know, we're having XYZ problem. If we had just come up with the right consequences, the right preventative action, the right solution, we could fix the problem. But a lot of times that doesn't exist. Many times there are multiple ways that you could handle a situation. And I don't know that there's, I think at least sometimes, there's not much significance in how it's handled, but that you do something about it. You communicate to the people involved, this is okay, this is not okay. As authorities, we're called to be a reflection of God's values. This is okay, this is not okay. So label the action, speech, or attitude clearly. Build empathy and sensitivity. Build empathy and sensitivity. In practical sense, that means practice the golden rule. How would you feel if you were treated like this? How would you feel if that happened to you? Provide structure, supervision. Back to the story I told you at the beginning of the two little boys who got roughed up by their classmate. Theoretically, it was structured, but in actuality, it didn't play out that way. And I understand, as teachers, as board members, we want our students to do well. We want our schools to be safe places. But be aware that things can happen without us knowing. Are we doing what we can to keep things supervised on the playground? Are there corners of the playground that we can't see, that we don't visit? Are there things that are happening on the van ride, the bus ride, to and from school that should be addressed? What about the restrooms? I think it definitely helps that if you've got brothers and sisters both teaching school. When you have a small school, that doesn't always happen, and the guy's restroom can become the place where things happen that shouldn't. Are we doing what we can to provide structure and supervision? And the final thing I would mention is, let's develop school culture and identity. We are a group. We look out for each other. You belong. You're one of us. You know, I remember specifically two students that I had in my class when I first started teaching. We were a pretty small school at that point. And they were polar opposites, wired completely different. And if there would have been more options, they probably wouldn't ever have become good friends. But they were best friends because that was who was there, and they did things together, and they accepted each other, and they were a part of this. We are different, but we make up one. One school, one class, one youth group, one church. The things that we can help them learn in school will pay off in other places as well. I'd like to share a quote from Nancy Beardall, who said, "It's all about connection. When students feel connected to their peers, their school, and their community, they do better." And also the quote by Mark Van Clay, which you have on your handout. "Cultural glue is required to provide a receptive host for any long-term, sustainable school improvement efforts." But I believe we have the recipe for that cultural glue. That's our oneness in Christ, our faith in Christ, our belonging to the church. But I believe it's valuable for us to put energy into helping our students work through these issues at school, because they're going to carry right over into the youth group and into the church unless we can help them resolve some of these things. I would summarize it with the word relationship. And in closing, I'd like to share a burden. It comes out of Matthew chapter 25. You're familiar with the verse, the scripture where Jesus is talking to them at the end of time. I'll just read. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was anhungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Three of those aspects, three things that he mentioned, are strictly and purely relationship. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Spending time together, building relationship. But notice the price of not having invested in relationship. It's when he tells them, Depart from me, I never knew you. And he gives the reason why. Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it, or inasmuch as ye have not done it, unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. We're accountable before Almighty God for our response to the least of these. Cliques and bullying damage people and damage our schools. You need to do our part to mitigate these issues among our people. Our schools need to be a safe place. I'd like to just open it up if there are any questions or comments, thoughts. Like I said, I don't profess to be an expert on it. Something I care about, but there's a lot of experience, a lot of wisdom here. Anybody have? Yes?
You mentioned toward the end of your year it got better and you addressed some underlying relationship issues. Is that one-on-one with students or parents involved, or what kind of discussions happened there?
Some of all of the above. Part of it was there was like the weeds. The example that I gave, you clip it with the scissors. So the only way to take care of the weed problem is to get to the root, right? I was working with the information I had. I was clipping the tops off. And things kept on going. So part of it was students finally sharing some of what was actually going on. And some of the falsehoods that were being believed, some of the things that were happening. And it was on both sides. I mean, it was clicks and counter clicks and whatever. Like I said, it was a mess. But part of it was sitting down with the group and saying, okay, you guys here are the key. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to build our school, make it a good place, my classroom, or are you going to continue to destroy it? Like, we have to do some forgiving and moving on. And yeah, there were some parental involvement. It was, we just tried to work at it from a number of different ways. And like I said, it felt like it got better, but it wasn't really solved. But I think some of those things laid the foundation for students to come back this year and say, this year is going to be different. Some of the ones who were instrumental in creating the issues last year. And in a lot of ways, it's gone much, much better. And part of that is student dynamics, some of the ones who aren't there this year. But I think a lot of it is back to them saying, you know, this, they knew it wasn't right, and we need to do better, we need to do differently. You know, of course, I'm trying not to assume that it's because I'm not there, but the thought crossed my mind.
What grade was that?
I've got grades 7 through 12. And so, yeah, they're right in that age when they're a lot of fun, but it can be complicated. That's probably the best way to put it. Yeah.
I think you just brought up a pretty good point. I think a lot of situations, especially on the click level, they know that what they're doing isn't right, but they don't know how to get out of doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, cool is as cool does, and if you don't do it, you're not in there. But nobody wants to stoop out of being cool if that's what the situation is or whatever.
Exactly.
To make it happen. But the, you know, they recognize that if they come back saying this year's going to be different, they knew what they're doing. And sitting down and addressing that. Yeah.
I don't think they deliberately set out to make last year bad. They just were reacting and weren't thinking. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and that's why I think it's so important for us as leaders to label things and to help them say, okay, this is not okay, this is okay, and help them understand how would you feel if the things, because children can be incredibly cruel to each other. I guess adults can too, right? Yeah.
I don't want to monopolize anything. How do you address click leaders? Like, you can certainly, you know, it's quite obvious, and it's a very negative influence.
Somebody have a word on that? Like I said, I'm not the expert, but there's a lot of experience here. How do you address click leaders? Yeah.
You talk about a root, you got to dig till you get to the root. Mm-hmm. It's going to take time.
So you're saying to try to develop a relationship with that?
Yeah, you're going to dig until you get to the root. Mm-hmm. It's too easy just to clip the tops off and it looks good then. But you know, if we're going to get to the root of the problem, we're going to dig till we get to.
I've just been challenged on a personal level when someone came up to me and said, you know, you have more influence than you realize. Mm-hmm. And I took a young man out for breakfast from church a while back, who was creating some ripples, and I said, you know, you have more influence than you realize. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes they don't think of how their actions are affecting the people.
Excellent points. That's probably the approach I would take to come back to that, is help them understand, look, you have the power to influence the people around you and to create change. You know, you're not a bad person. And that's one of the things that I discovered in doing research for this. They had almost no change in the behavior patterns in the school when they tried just directly going after the bullies and trying to shame them into quitting. And you know, the whole difference between guilt and shame. You know, guilt is feeling bad about something you've done. Shame is more an assessment of your value as a person. Okay, so you have a lot of value, you have a lot of potential, but you have some bad behaviors, and it's making it difficult for other people. How would you feel if you were, and you know, you have no clue how much it's going to impact this student who's kind of getting pushed to the back if, you know, sometime you and your friends are doing something and you say, hey, come, let's, you know, make it a friendship, make room for more people. But it's, like I said, it's complicated. There are many nuances. How do you help them? And especially if the adults in their life aren't modeling good friendships, it becomes difficult. But I think we can still shine the light in dark places. Yes.
Speaking of getting to the root, are the instigators like usually children that are hurting themselves?
I think a lot of times it can be that way.
Maybe not always, but
yeah, that's, I'm assuming it's gonna vary by situation. Or does somebody have a thought on that? Like they said like a pure bully was somebody who was well-connected socially and had a pretty good self-image, pretty good self-esteem, and was still being a bully. So that's a problem. But I think if we can help, so I don't think the answer is just totally saying that you're doing this because of something else. If we're not careful, we're gonna say, you're not really responsible. It's this other instance that's causing that. But I would definitely be aware of that going into it, because many times we relate to others out of our pain or our wounds without realizing it. and being able to address it, feel your way through it, because I'd say it's a very good possibility you're right, but not always. Sometimes it's just a matter of just being uncaring and callous, you know. I mean, I maybe give you a little bit of an illustration of that, you know, why do my seventh grade boys get a big kick out of taking a frog and just like cruelly dismembering, like kill it or like let him alone, right? Like why, just not having empathy. And I think we can cultivate an awareness. How would you feel if you were, the situation was reversed and you were on the receiving end of this? You know, would that, how, and all of a sudden the lights come on, it's like, oh, yeah, that really isn't, sometimes they just haven't thought about it before. But I'll definitely start with that, because a lot of times we do relate out of our own wounds. Yes?
I'd love to hear some input on effective way of talking to parents. And, you know, bullying is not the county's high school. It can happen in our school. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, you know, well, I didn't know I was in school too kind of thing. Is there any tips to addressing parents? Maybe at a parent-teacher's conference or something to raise awareness of this?
Any input? Yes.
As a parent-teacher meeting, when all the parents are together, it would be a good topic to have somebody address, to discuss, to think about as parents.
That would avoid the issue of having parents feel like they're singled out or picked on, or they're being bullied by you addressing it. Like I said, it's complicated, a lot of nuances and things going on here. But I like that idea of addressing it with the whole group. It's more like saying, hey, we have a problem, can we work on it together? You know, make sure you're talking to your children about how does God want us to treat other people? How do you want to be treated? And yeah, there are some people that are going to be better friends than others, but that never gives us the right to be exclusive or harsh. Yes?
So this is my first year as a school administrator, just to give you an idea of my experience level, but we have a problem at our school with unkind words. You could call it verbal bullying. There was definitely specific instances. And I found it, we brought it up at PTF. I've had individual conversations with parents, and something that we felt was very effective was we got the parents on board with the vision of let's get the situation better at school, let's get the school culture so that we build up with our words. We actually made a paper candle. Whenever someone said a kind word, they got to put a little piece of paper in the candle, and the candle was full, we had a pizza party. And it was amazing transformation. And we haven't arrived anywhere yet. But it was, the students were thinking about their words and thinking about, like, what can I say positive? Mm-hmm. And the school culture actually improved a lot. It came from the parents, it came from the school faculty, and everybody was in the same vision together. So I think sometimes isolating individual behaviors is important, but maybe also making it a broader vision goal as well.
I like what you did. Instead of going after the negative, you cast a positive vision. You know, we're going to squash this whenever it shows up, and then you're like, oh, that cranky guy who, you know. No, we're not going to focus on that. We're going to focus on what we want to do, what we want to see. And that's much more compelling, and the students got into it, and yeah, it's good stuff.
As a parent, if I don't know my child is involved, I can't do anything at home. Like,
exactly.
I want the teacher to come to me.
Exactly.
But maybe not all parents do.
Parents are scary. But no, you're right. So what happens is it comes back to communication. We have to communicate, and there has to be the kind of communication between the parents and the teacher that is comfortable and is open, like you're on the same team. So administrators, principals, go back home and put a plug in for your teachers to call parents out of the blue and tell them five amazing things their student is doing, okay? The more positive interaction, the more positive affirmation you can have, the better it's going to go when you do need to deal with those negative issues. I've seen that over and over and over again. You know, oh, the teacher's calling. I wonder what's wrong now. Well, that's bad news. Like, positive.
He'll text and say, you know what? I really appreciate your time in the classroom. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Because then
That explains why you want to know when he's not amazing.
It does. It's yeah. huge. I'm like, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, come on.
I was going to say that's one of the big reasons I am in favor of sending my children to school versus parent school is to have more odds and ears. If my mm-hmm. children are can't behave in school, it's going to show up later. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm not even in ministry, and next year I'll be principal, but I can talk from a patron's standpoint. Mm-hmm. And that is that very fact that as parents, that we can't dictate how parents feel about that. I wouldn't feel we should have a lot of effort in communicating with parents.
Exactly right. And parents aren't all going to see it the same way, you know. But, and that's the part I'm not sure what to do with when you have parents who say, well, what's the big deal? I mean, some people are just better friends than others. Like, well, okay, but how are we going to build a sense of community when we're okay with those kind of attitudes? Yes, in the back.
Sometimes we think that this, is a child's issue and they'll grow out of it after a while. I appreciate the emphasis you put on it. If it starts in the school, it's going to move into the youth group and the church. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can say, there's something wrong with that youth group. Maybe we need to look what's wrong with the school. Let's start with the school that's falling. So I appreciate your bringing that point out and making that analysis.
Thanks for that input. I think we're supposed to be done. Any other comments or questions quick before we wrap up? Thanks for your participation, and thanks for being here. It tells me you care, at least at a certain level, about relationships in our schools. And Lord bless you as you invest where God's called you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. For additional recordings produced by the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee, visit the Dock for Learning at www.thedockforlearning.org.